which gives the most direct connection with SLE. And then the issue of the scale limit, what we call the full scale limit, which is in terms of all interfaces of the perturbation model. And then from there, you can go on and talk about what we call a near critical scale limit. So I will start slowly with, I guess, a single interface and make the connection with SLE. But I guess you should tell me at some point I have to speed up or to skip some parts or which direction you want to go. So I don't know how many people are actually familiar with percolation, so I can start with the model. But the model we consider is, at this point, it's the model itself is very simple. It's just a random coloring of hexagons where you color, say, blue with probability p and yellow with probability 1 minus p, independently. And as I said, it's a very simple model, but it's interesting both mathematicians and physicists because it's maybe the simplest model where you can see a cyberoid phase transition. And I'll go, I'm not even sure this is necessary, but just to remind you what I mean by that is if you look at, so the error parameter here, the function you're looking at is the probability. So you select one hexagon from which you call the origin, and then you look at the probability of this piece, the density of the small piece of density of blue hexagons, and then you look at the probability of the origin in the blue cluster, and this blue cluster is infinite. So the origin is connected by blue path infinity. And if you look at this function, you see that it's zero for values of p up to 1/2, including 1/2, and then it starts to explode, and then you have a power law behavior. And there are three regimes. When p, the density of blue hexagons, is less than 1/2, then all the blue clusters are finite, and the expectation, so the expected size of blue clusters, so the blue cluster of the origin, is finite. If p is bigger than 1/2, then you do have an infinite blue cluster somewhere. So the probability that the origin is in an infinite blue cluster is positive. That is somewhat, in some sense, the most interesting case is just the single point, the phase diagram, that's a critical point where you don't have an infinite cluster, but the mean cluster size is infinite. And so that means, if you want to define a scale, or look for a scale for your system, when p is less than 1/2, you can simply take the mean cluster size. That gives you a physically relevant scale for your system. If p is bigger than 1/2, you can just look at the yellow components instead of the blue ones because you have the signature to change their color. But if you're trying to do that at 1/2, you're going to fail because the mean cluster size is infinite. So in the physics language, we would say that the correlation length diverges and we have scale invariance. Remember that I typically give this talk to mathematicians, so I call it physics wisdom. That's you can always use that. When you talk to a mathematician, you want to say something which is not very precise, you can blame the physicist and say, okay, this is what physicists will say. It works, and they're going to ask questions. And say,
do you know whether it works?
So in some sense, the most interesting case is this one, and this is what I will be considering, at least for the... I'm not sure I will get to the near critical case, so until there, I will fix p to be 1/2 and consider the critical case. So now from here, now of course if you're looking at a scale invariant system, then it's natural to take a scaling limit. That means you start with the lattice model and you have lattice spacing delta and let it go to zero. And in physics language, then if you're looking at a critical lattice model, you're supposed to get something which is because of the problem fill theory. So now the connection with SLE, the most direct connection with SLE, here comes by looking at this object, which was introduced by Red Trump, which called the proportional exploration pattern can be constructed in the following way. Suppose you restrict, you look at the proportional exploration in the, say, the upper half plane, so you look only the serial half of the hexagonal lattice, and you impose some special boundary conditions, which is, so you have black hexagons to the left, what we call the origin, and white hexagons to the right. And in here you have a random proportional configuration. But the choice of boundary conditions forces the presence of two intimal clusters, one black and one white, and there will be a unique interface between them. And when you take the scaling limit, this is going to converge, in a perfect sense, to a cordial SLE 6. Okay. So at this point, I need to know exactly, I mean, how much am I supposed to explain about the meaning of convergence and what do you exactly know about SLE? And should I sort of quickly remind, review, or explain how you get there?
I would like to understand that this curve, you say that there is one curve,
yes,
which is interface. The condition is that it should start from this edge from below.
Right. You have a special edge. So the boundary conditions are, you have all the hexagons to the left, this is semi-infinite line.
Well, the condition is that it must start from this edge.
Yes, it does start from there, and all the hexagons here are white, so you have a special edge which is starting point, and then there will be a unique interface between these two interfaces. And then one interesting thing is that you can actually, or you can think of this interface, well, you should think of this interface as an interface, so as an object that sits there, but you can actually think of this in dynamical terms, in the sense that you can construct it dynamically. If you think of it, it is kind of it looks like, in a way, like a random walk, in the sense that you know that you have this edge, and then you can construct it in the following way, and that your name in some sense comes from there. You want to add edges at every time step. So what you do is you start here, you look at this hexagon, and look at its color. That's equivalent to flipping a fair coin, and then if the color is white, you go left. If the color is blue, you go right. And then you can proceed in this fashion. And this is kind of a random walk. You go randomly left to right, it's same for blue, except that you have memory. Because when you go back to the hexagon that you have already visited, say, at some point the walk comes back here, for example, then you remember the color. You have already discovered. An interesting something...
But for a given configuration of this hexagons, you have only one.
Only one, yes. But you can imagine that you don't know the configuration and you're going to explore it. And in fact, if you do it this way, you see that you don't need to know the whole configuration. There are many, many, many hexagons whose color you will not discover. There's only a fraction of the hexagons that are the ones to the left, immediately to the left and to the right of the curve, that you need to know what color is.
For those. Just in answer to your question, we have lots of talks about SLE, but it would be nice to hear in what sense this curve converges, or just to say a few words about.
Okay, I can that in a few words. So the one thing that I would ask to mention is what is special about SLE6, and there's this locality property of SLE6, and one way to understand it is to understand it in the discrete model, but actually that's actually very simple. You see, if you think of this curve in these terms, is this, the description that I just gave you in terms of the exploration path, you will see that the shape of the curve, suppose I sort of try to construct the curve, I don't know the configuration, and I use this sort of dynamical way of exploring the curve. If I get to a certain point, right, and I keep doing the same thing. I look at this hexagon, which is equivalent to flipping a fair coin. I look at the color, and I keep moving. And the only times when I need to know the color of the boundary
is when I actually hit the boundary. Okay? So this tells you that the shape of the curve is, when you're away from the boundary, is not at all influenced by the boundary itself. So in fact, I really don't need to tell you what the boundary, the fact that I assign colors to the boundary, this is just to make the picture look better, but it is really irrelevant. I could simply give you a dynamical description, which is say, okay, every new hexagon, you flip the first coin, you go left or right, depending on what you get. When you hit the boundary is naturally divided in two parts. If you're on the left part of the boundary, then you go right. If you're on the right part of the boundary, you go left, without telling you anything about the color. This also tells you that, I mean, if I modify the domain, okay, whenever I'm away from the boundary, this does not modify the curve at all. And here, you're doing this in the upper half plane, but in general, I can do this, I can pick any domain, right, and I select two points. Here, the two points are what I call the origin there, and the other point is infinity, so I have a curve that started the origin and goes infinity. Here I would have, I can select two points, and then the equivalent thing would be I color the two portions of the boundary of two different colors. If I have blue and yellow, I can use blue and yellow. And then I have an SOE curve in between. Or, in the discrete setting, I have an exploration path in between. Now, what is special about SOE, or SOE6, or what is special about percolation is that because everything is independent, there are really no correlations. So if I decide at some point to modify the boundary, and I don't know, to change it from here to something like this, if I do this far away from the tip of the curve, the evolution of the curve is not going to change. Okay. So the way the curve evolves is not dependent on the shape of the boundary far away. Okay. If you imagine having an easing model instead of a percolation model, this is not going to be true, of course. Because when you change the boundary, you have correlations, so you have the effect is going to be felt also far away. For creating these models.
So that's called the restriction property?
Well, no, that's called the locality property.
Is it different from
restriction? It is related, but it's different.
Antonio
Bergstrom,
Kappa=6.
The locality property only works on Kappa=6. You can prove it, well, in the discrete model, I guess it's obvious.
This model, yeah, but I think it's.
You can prove it, and you can prove it using the Lerner equation practice for the SOE series. You can actually prove it, but that will take some time. I mean, I wanted to explain it in the discrete setting because there is it's kind of obvious, and this property survives in the scaling limit. So you can say, well, that's why SOE 6 has it. I like to think of SOE 6 as a scaling limit of percolation. So about in a couple of words, convergence should be interpreted in the following sense. This is a random curve because you have a random configuration. The distribution or the probability of this curve is induced by the percolation model. So here you have a product measure. So every hexagon has a color with probability one half is black and one half is white. So you have a random curve with the distribution, and the curve depends on the parameter delta, which is the lattice spacing. Now the question in sort of mathematical terms is, I have a measure or a distribution, probability distribution from this curve, which depends on the parameter delta, and I'm looking at the following thing, so I put it mu, for example, delta, and the point is, if I let delta go to zero, what do I get? And so the convergence is intended in distribution. Now, if I want to do that, I would have to give you a topology, because this would it gets a little bit more complicated. I mean, in the case of a single curve, it's actually not so complicated. You can think of the metric on well, this is an interface, so you really don't you don't care about the parameterization. So you should think of this curve up to monotonic free parameterizations. So you could think of a metric in which curves are elements of the space are curves, and two curves are close if they sort of shadow each other, if they stay close to each other. So if up to reparameterizations, you can make them stay close to each other.
Can you change the size of the hexagons in some way?
Yeah, that's not what you're going to do. I mean, delta is the size of the hexagons, and then you let delta go to zero. This is the scaling. And so the curve will become, here is a sort of polygonal curve, will become it's already a continuous curve, but it will.
So can you do something that kind of goes the other way?
So my question is sort of, is an extremely unlikely curve there, does it converge to an extremely unlikely SLE?
Well, you cannot really, you cannot think of convergence point-wise.
It's
not point-wise. I mean, if you think of this, probably if you say almost surely, then you don't get angry. Because
it's not so bad to think like that.
What?
It's not so bad to think that way.
It's not so bad. That's actually kind of useful, but it's not.
Well, I'm sure.
So the next issue that I wanted to talk about, I will get to it soon, is you can think of the scaling unit also in terms of loops. Instead of looking at a single interface, you can look at, suppose I go back to the original question where I look at the full plane, I don't have any boundary conditions. In this case, I cannot single out one interface. I have many interfaces, infinitely many. And because, as I told you, at the critical point, all clusters are finite with probability one, then if I follow an interface, no matter how big, how large it is, eventually it will come back to itself form a loop. Okay. So what I have here is a collection of loops. So one question is, can I describe the scaling unit in terms of collections of loops? And this is what we call the full scaling unit. So you could ask the same type of question, in what sense should I understand this limit and this convergence? And if you try to understand it point-wise, here it's quite clear that you don't get anything in a way, because suppose you point-wise would mean you fix a configuration and you look at the loops and then you start shrinking. Okay, any loop, no matter how big it is, when delta goes to zero will disappear. So everything will disappear. For every configuration, everything will disappear. So I cannot make sense of the limit in this way. In order to make sense of the limit, I have to talk about distributions. I hope this answers the question.
So, I mean, you could look at, like when you have convergence, like the Brownian motion, you look at the probabilities for where the path is at different times, and those probabilities converge. Here you can look at the locations of this interface when it hits various, say circles around the starting point, and the distribution of those locations will converge to the corresponding things for SLE.
But there's no,
So you could look at probabilities of certain events, and those like crossing probabilities, and those would converge.
Yes, probabilities of certain events will converge, but when you say convergence in measure, then you probably...
Yeah, the right way would be to say convergence in distribution measure.
But there could be, you know, one curve which, you know, had a length proportional to the area of the system, a very unusual one. And would that correspond to some very unusual realization of Brownian motion in the SLE?
I guess it depends what you mean by correspond.
Well, so it's not one-to-one.
I guess in some sense the answer is yes. I mean,
when you talk about convergence measure, you only talk about events that have positive probabilities.
Yes.
But the topology
there are lots of events that
But the positive you're using is quite strong in the sense that it's really, in some sense, it's true that you could, as delta goes to zero, if you look at a curve, it really kind of approximates, in some sense, an SLE. It looks more like an SLE.
Length is probably a bad example.
Yeah, length is.
Well, length is a really bad example, but no, I specifically chose it to be a bad example.
No, but I mean, suppose you had a curve which stayed away from the boundary. That's an unlikely.
Yeah.
Both unlikely for the lattice and unlikely for SLE.
Yeah. So this thing, conditioned to stay away from the boundary, does or does not converge to SLE condition?
Yes.
I'm not sure. Or even though the SLE is conditioned to stay away, that's
That's an SLE in Kappa Rho.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, because of the topology that you're using, which is. It's in some sense like saying that
in percolation,
random walk approximates
running away from the boundaries of it. But for some other value of kappa.
Yeah, the main problem now is kappa is more complicated. But here we do the random locality.
Yeah.
But in some sense, it's like saying that we said that the random walk approximates the giant motion. It's because of the topology that you have from the curve. I'm not sure I should go over this slide. I guess you probably have I'm not sure what's happening. This is something we discussed already. You have the polygonal curve, which depends on delta. And you take a scaling image, you get some random curve on this is an SLE6 path. And should I skip this part? And then you can do a.
We had him
over. You can do a Durbin chain analysis to get a running motion.
I guess the question, if you go back to the discrete and to the calculation, you get sort of like some discrete analog of the equation.
Yes.
That you see the running.
No, that's true. That's true. In fact, you can define a discrete Durbin chain. And if you look at the discrete Durbin chain, you will have a driving function. When you got delta equal to zero, you can actually see that the driving function converges to driving function. Mm-hmm. And in fact,
is it a very complicated driving function, or is it just a...
No, actually, it should look more or less like sort of a running walk. It obviously has IA.
Except that in fact it's not quite conformal change there.
No, it's that's right. Well, I mean, up to some error that there's zero. That's the whole. But in fact, if this is how Lauer-Fram and Werner proved the convergence for example, loop-based random walk to SLE2. You look at a discrete Durbin chain, and then you look at the driving function, and you show that the driving function converges to driving motion. This is at least one piece of the proof.
So these are curves that are piecewise linear, piecewise straight lines. So
right. Yeah, because they're in the discrete setting, these are straightwise linear, and then when you take the scaling limit, of course, you get something which is going to be very weakly. Sort of just having straight pieces of this one. Okay, so now this was I'll skip this one as well. You've heard, I guess, how once you put in this conformal Markov property that is defined the driving, determines the driving function and tells you the driving function and the driving motion. So I'll safely skip this one. So, if I skip all of this, then let me go. Well, I go back to where I wanted to begin with. So in fact, the idea of the top is to talk about the full scale of limit. So the full scale of limit is, like I said before, now throw away your exploration path. I mean, go back to the original question. If you think of this, the picture of the exploration path gives you a connection with SLE. And that's very good and that's very useful because it allows you, SLE, one of the good things about SLE is that it allows you to do computations. You can compute crossing probabilities, you can get critical exponents. So for example, you can derive rigorously critical exponents and also get critical exponents that were not known previously. But like I said, there's actually much more stuff around. I mean, in a percolation model, you're interested in questions of connectivity. So if you take two hexagons, are they in the same cluster or not? And it's sort of obvious that if you look at a single interface in this setting, this cannot give you enough, doesn't contain enough information to answer all these type of questions. And there are many more interfaces going around. So it's definitely a natural question to ask. Suppose I look at a model, percolation model, in the full plane without any constraints, without any boundary conditions, then I have a bunch of loops. Can I define, then do I have a scaling limit in terms of this collection of loops? And obviously, I mean, if you look at a piece of an interface, a piece of a large loop, sort of locally, it looks like a piece of the exploration path that you saw in the previous picture. So the sort of obvious answer is, well, scaling limit should exist, and it should maybe be made of loops, and these loops should be made up of SLE6 paths. This is all going to be true in the end. The question is, how do you get SLE, portal SLE, to make loops? And how do you describe this scaling limit in terms of full collection of loops? And so what I wanted to explain is sort of the connection between a single curve, SLE6, and the full scaling limit in terms of loops. And this is going to be related very much to what Scott is going to be talking about tomorrow. So this conformal loop ensembles. So before I try to explain what the connection between a single SLE is and the full scaling limit, let me just, in case we don't have time to go back to this later, let me just list some properties of this object. So now you're looking at a collection of all loops in a percolation configuration, and again, I'm taking a scaling limit, and again, in terms of distribution. So if the scaling limit exists, which it does actually, what you get is a probability measure on collections of loops in the plane. And this is what we call the full scaling limit, and these are some of the properties that you can prove about this object. So it is, first of all, a random, it's a countable collection of loops. The loops are non-simple in the sense that, like SLE6 has a lot of self-touching, so the loops have a lot of self-touching, and they touch each other a lot. These loops are, in some sense, all over the place, and the collection itself is conformally invariant, and there are various ways in which you can see the conformally invariance, and we're not going into details. You can see that, so
you've got lots and lots of, there are very, very small loops.
You have got lots and lots of very small ones.
But it's still countable, so.
It's still countable, yes.
And that you prove.
Yes, you can see that it's still countable. But they're all over the place in the sense that.
So you have an explicit bijection with the big integers, or? I mean, when you say it's countable, what do you actually mean?
Yes, you can put them in bijection with your integers. That's the definition.
The reason that we know it's countable is because the construction is kind of an inductive construction.
Oh, it's an inductive construction.
Yes, I will try to show you something. So you can actually enumerate the steps in the construction. So. And that's how you put them in, at every step.
But it's hardly non-unique.
The construction we have is highly non-unique. There's a lot of, arbitrary choices that you can make still. And it's actually, in terms of, as far as the proof is concerned, that's one of the things you have to prove. Given this construction, since you have a lot of arbitrary choices that you can make, you have to show that all the possible choices give you the same object. But if I get there, it will be kind of obvious, at least in the street level. So they said, I mean, they're countable, but there are many of them, they're all over the place. In fact, if you pick any, if you miss a point in the place, in the plane, you will have infinitely many loops around this point with radius going to zero. And also there's a family of infinitely many loops going to with radius going to infinity. And another thing which would have been very useful to say, but I don't think I will have time to get to the near critical case, but there's a lot of touching. And if you, this is a somewhat surprising property of first sight at least, if you pick a configuration of loops out of this probability measure, and then with probability one, if you pick any two loops, you can choose them, then there is a kind of a path of loops that allows you to go. So suppose you choose this one, this small one in there, and so you pick this loop, and you pick this one, you can always go from this to that by jumping from one loop to this loop touches this big one, so you jump to this big one. From here you can jump to this one that touches this other one, and from here this loop will touch somewhere this other loop which touches this one. So there's always kind of a path of touching loops, and this allows you to go in actually a small, well, we don't have estimates, but in any case you could get some, in a kind of small number of steps you can go from any loop to any other loop, just by jumping on other loops that touch each other. And this is actually a very fundamental property of percolation, which has a lot to do with why you can use this description to try to get to the near critical scale of loops.
So when you say it's an important property of percolation, like the Ising model clusters,
no, you're not going to have that.
Not longer.
No, you're not going to have that. I guess it depends on which.
You mean FK clusters?
FK clusters, yes. But if you look at the Ising clusters,
well, it depends if you're critical or supercritical. Percolation is a special case of the Ising model.
Percolation is a special case of the Ising model.
So that one.
But I guess when you say Ising, I think of critical Ising. Because if you're supercritical Ising, it's the same as.
Yeah, let's say critical Ising.
Yeah, because if you're supercritical, you should get the same scaling as in percolation. At least this is what the normalization will tell you.
I have one question. If I'm in the sweet case, then I certainly know where the loop is. But
yeah.
If I'm in the continuum, then somehow, what defines the loop? I mean, I'm touching points, I mean, those things really touch. And so, I mean, how do you know that the little piece which I find there doesn't seem to be part of the big loop?
I know it because of the choice of the topology. In fact, I keep track, when I take the scaling limit, I do keep track of the loops.
Yeah,
so there is a lot of touching, but I know which way I have to go.
In the case, that's the
but also in the continuum case, because the loops are curves. So the curve, you know, when you have two curves touching, you know which one is one and which one is the other. This is why you have to choose the right topology. You cannot look at this object in terms of the city house topology. Then when you have touching, you don't know which one is which. Here you're really thinking of loops in terms of they are curves, so they have a parameterization. It's in the end irrelevant because you can really curves, you should think of these objects as curves have to be parameterization, but you do have actually curves. They're not just the set of points.
Yeah.
But it's useful.
If you could think of the curve as just a set of points in the plane, but this is not a curve. This is a geometric object. But you want to think of a curve with the parameterization. So, I mean, I can give you an example. If I draw for you this, And I, can everybody see it? So these are curves, not only they are curves that cannot intersect, they can touch, but there is no self-intersection. So if I give you this as a set of points, this is not the same object as a curve. I mean, as a curve, you could, if I give you a parameterization, I can tell you that the curve goes this way, and this is allowed. But I could also give you a parameterization where the curve does this, crosses over, and this would not be allowed. So in terms of set of points, the first one and the second one are the same thing, but they're not the same curve. And one curve touches itself and does not cross itself, and the other one crosses itself. So they are really two different curves.
And also with the one in which you have exactly that same set, but instead of two curves which happen to touch there, that's a different configuration and very far away.
That you call topology or?
Well,
because it's more just floating around without being defined.
I wouldn't call it that second example. I wouldn't call it topology. It's a question of what's the definition of your configuration space. Right. Configuration space here is a collection of curves or loops, except modulo reparametrization. But then you also have to find what it means to be near each other.
And it's a metric on that score.
Yes, that's a metric.
But the point is that two things which touch this way is a different configuration than one that looks like that. That's just quite different. And of course, they're very far apart in the metric.
Yes. Maybe what you just want is a loop is a continuous map from a circle into the plane. And it's that map defined up to parametrization. And I can say, if I want to give a metric on the pair of loops, one or two loops close to each other, then this is something that they do.
The metric is something that you can choose a parameter. Things are, with an epsilon, if you can choose a parametrization of each, so that you're always with an epsilon.
If you want another example,
can you find the closest distance between two loops?
So look at these two curves. I mean, say these two curves are close, right? In terms of the topology theory, and they're also close in terms of the Hausdorff topology, which means simply as looking at them as sets. Okay, the distance is. But suppose that you look at this curve and then I take this one. In terms of the Hausdorff topology, if you simply look at them as sets, collection of points, these are very close because there's no point of the red one which is far away from the blue one. But if you think of these as curves, there's no way you can reparameterize the red one so that it always stays close to the blue one. I mean, if you follow them, here you're fine, you can go. So at every instant of time, you should, the two points on either curve, they should be close to each other. So I can try to do this, I can get to here, but then at this point here, I have to go back. I mean, there's no way I'm going to be able to find a parameterization for both of them so that the two points stay always close from time zero to the end. So this is the topology. In this sense, these two curves are close, these two are not close.
So you want to say formally?
I didn't want to say formally.
You define the distance between two loops to be the infimum over all pairs of parameterizations of all loops.
I think this is good.
It's the premium of the distance.
Well, no, yeah, it's a problem. It's a, well, okay, it's a soup norm. I like it better, too. I wasn't doubting that physicists would understand it, I think, but I understand it better by this, than with the formula, with the original soup. Anyway, so let me see, I have
How much, 5 minutes?
Yeah, well, let's say, no, you started at a quarter past, so maybe we go to a quarter past unless somebody, is there objection to this?
So let me give you, okay, I could try to explain how to construct the loops out of a single SME curve. Or maybe I could also sort of jump to the near critical scheduling and say something about that. So let me try to define the loops and then show how to get them. So let me now consider the following problem. Imagine I'm looking at, I will not jump right away to the full plane, but I'm going to try to define the loops inside a bounded domain to start with. So suppose I'm looking at some bounded domain. I look at the population configuration inside, and I have a bunch of loops. And what I will try to do is to give you a kind of algorithmic construction that finds all the loops. Okay, and I will do this in the discrete setting. And the scaling limit of this, which is sort of in an obvious way repeating the same procedure, but at each step, instead of doing an exploration path, you sort of draw an SLE 6 curve, gives you the scaling limit of the loops. Okay? But I will do this at least at the beginning in the discrete setting because it's much simpler. So if you want to get your hands on the loops that are inside here, now the problem is where do you start? If you have a situation in which you have the boundaries colored in two colors, so half of the boundary say is yellow and the other half of the boundary is blue, well, then it's easy in the sense that, and so we're going back to the previous problem when you wanted to look at a single interface, and you know where to start. You know that the interface will start here and stop there. You can simply explore. You can simply sort of find out where it is, and you draw the interface. Okay. Now here you don't have a place where you don't know where to start because suppose that, so now I'm considering the case in which I have a monochromatic boundary. Okay, but remember what I told you. I told you that actually, because we're talking about percolation, what happens inside the domain does not depend at all on the color of the boundary. Okay, so the interface that I have inside are completely in their shape, it's completely independent of the boundary. In fact, I don't need to tell you what the color of the boundary is. I mean, this is so. The starting point could simply be, I start. You imagine that this is the domain where I want to find all the loops. This part, these special hexagons are the outer boundary. They do not belong to the domain itself. But I want to find the loops in a situation in which this is a monochromatic boundary. We say it's a blue boundary. Okay. But because this is percolation. The color of the boundary itself does not have any influence on what the shape of the interfaces is inside, away from the boundary. So I'm going to do something which is the following. I pick two points, A and B, and I decide that for the moment I'm going to pretend that, well, I leave the color of the boundary here blue, I will pretend for the moment that this part of the boundary is yellow instead. And if I do that, then I can define, like previous equation, I can define an exploration path from A to B. Okay. Now, the thing is that the pieces of the curve inside, they're real. I mean, they're interfaces, they're there. I haven't done anything to them. This is not an easy model, this is percolation. So the fact that I pretend for the moment that this part of the boundary is yellow doesn't affect what's going on inside. But it gives me a way to start and find at least some pieces of interface inside. Now, at this point, after this first step, if you remove all the hexagons that you have explored by doing this first step, you will be left with some regions. In this picture, you have three. And you see that there are different types. Some of them, like this one and this one, they have a monochromatic boundary. Okay. So this, remember, the actual color of the boundary is blue. So this one has a monochromatic boundary. This one has a monochromatic yellow boundary. But there's a special region here, which has a, once you put back the real color of the boundary, it has a partly yellow, partly blue boundary. So if you focus on that one, so this is it, I removed the rest. This is a special region which now has two pieces of boundary, two colors, and that reminds you of this problem there. So in fact, knowing that you have a boundary which is partly one color, partly the other color, tells you there will be an interface in there. So the next step will be to take such a region and look for the interface inside it.
So this is the first time that your exploration processes
almost
hit the boundary.
Right, this is a very good something that you said. So this is a region which is determined by what you could call an excursion of the excursion of the boundary. So what you're doing here, you're artificially splitting the boundary in two, and then you basically want to split your exploration path into excursions, where an excursion is you call an excursion this, for example, this is an excursion. So when the exploration path leaves the boundary and then, for example, goes back here. But if you think of this, the reason why this works is because if you were to take away these colors and put the real configuration, percolation, random configuration everywhere, I mean, these excursions would be just pieces of loops. So what an exploration path is basically, if you think of it the right way, it's sort of pieces of loops that are put together through the boundary because you impose those special boundary conditions. So if you want to go back to the loops, you have to take your exploration path, chop it into pieces where the pieces are excursions, and then go find the other piece of the loop. So this is what this is what we're doing here. So.
But what do I do with loops that never hit the boundary?
Well, but there are no such loops. That's the point. I mean, so let me finish and then I come back to this. So the first step is you do this, then you focus on this domain of this special nature, and you know that there's going to be an interface there. You just do another step looking for the interface, and that corresponds to doing another exploration path, now in a new domain. And you see that when you end your exploration path, it will be closed. And so putting together this excursion of the first exploration path with the second exploration path, what you find is a loop. This is a real loop. This is really the boundary of a yellow cluster that touches the left part of the boundary of the original domain. You should also notice that in doing so, you might get, or you will get, other domains. In this case, the new domain that you get is a single hexagon. But every new domain that you get has a monochromatic boundary. Sure, you can see it. I mean, this is not a very good picture because it's kind of a small system. But when you do the second step, every new domain that you get inside here will have a monochromatic boundary. So after the first step, you can collect all the special domains with the mixed boundary. Inside each of them, you can do an exploration path, and you will get at the end a collection of loops. And now, if you look at your system, the whole thing again, we will be left with a bunch of domains, but all of them now have a monochromatic boundary. So you are sort of back to the original situation where you were starting with the domain with a monochromatic boundary. So now you can simply repeat, iterate what you did in the first step for each one of the other domains. And at each, and you keep doing this, and you will keep collecting. We will keep collecting loops. And it's
okay, your question before about what about loops that don't touch the original boundary? Well, there are such things, but they'll touch.
Yeah, eventually
they'll touch something which touched the boundary, or they'll touch something which touched something which stuck to the boundary.
Okay.
That's why in the end, the thing you end up with has this property that things are touching each other through a finite collection of path of touching things, or else you wouldn't get to them. All you have to show, though, that you don't miss anything that way. But if you did, it would violate something or other.
Yes. So it's at the discrete level, the lattice model is kind of obvious. In a finite number of steps, you get to discover all the loops that are there. Now, the scaling of this procedure is sort of the obvious, in a way, analogous procedure, where instead of doing exploration path, you put down SLV6 path. So suppose you do the, you want to do the analogous thing in the continuum setting, for example, in a domain which is a unit disk. What you would do is, well, you take your domain, you pick any two points you want, for example, the north pole and the south pole, you do an SLV6 inside, and then once you remove the SLV6, what you're left with is the union of various components. These are open sets, and they are, there are different types of sets. Type one is, are those that sort of have as part of the boundary the left part of the boundary, the unit disk, and those are the special ones, because those are the ones corresponding in the discrete setting to the special domains where you have a mixed boundary. So those are the ones where you are at the next step, you will take those and you will do an SLV6 inside, and then you will simply paste together the excursion from A to B with the SLV from B to A, and you get a loop. And you can sort of iterate this procedure, and well, you have to show that eventually this sort of this is in fact the scaling linear of the previous procedure in the strict setting, and it gives you the set of all loops. And if you're now basically you're done, because if you're interested in getting an object not in the boundary domain but in the full plane, well, you just have to take kind of an infinite volume limit. I mean, it's obvious that this procedure does not depend on the radius of the disk that I started with. So you can simply get the radius for the infinity, and then and this will give you an object or gas loops in the limit in the whole plane. And you can see that it's actually consistent. And I mean, in a way, if you look at any boundary condition around the origin, the full limits, I mean, the full plane object can be obtained as a limit in which you look at larger and what happens near the origin inside larger and larger disks.
You have a detailed question. You mentioned, so there is an excursion from A to B, but it's also an SLE from A to B.
Right.
So in SLE, if I just work with SLE, do these two have different probability distributions in it, or are they the same statistic? I mean, well, I work with SLE.
So the SLE
is these curves. Are you different?
The SLE is defined, I mean, I'm not sure I understand the question, but you the SLE is defined, you just give me a domain, whatever domain, and two points on the boundary, and I give you an SLE.
Sure.
So there's no problem of, you can, at every step, you can define an SLE in any boundary. Because of the conformal invariance, you could, if you like, you could imagine you could have sort of the standard SLE, which is wind the unit disk from the south pole to the north pole, and then you simply do a conformal map of the unit disk to this domain, and you look at the image. That's how you define actually SLE in different domains, if you want.
The second one is in a smaller domain than the first. It's in a domain that was created by the first one.
Yeah, I think I also see the difference. I mean, the excursion doesn't actually hit the boundary between A and B.
No, that's the definition of excursion.
That's the excursion is
right. Yeah. So the excursion is this piece, and the domain is in fact where you do the second SLE does not contain, for example, this one. The domain is, so you have to look at what you want the boundary of of the excursion. The domain is the open set, the connected open set. Okay. So then you can iterate this procedure. For example, if you want to find the loops that are inside here, you can sort of iterate the same procedure there. You take any two points that you like, and then you keep going. But, yeah.
It's a Lobner equation which describes both sides of the loop. Or?
Sorry?
Can
you talk a bit louder?
Is there a Lobner equation which describes both sides of this loop?
The Lobner equation for the loops.
That describes both pieces, is that? So was the question?
What do you mean by both sides?
Yeah. Well, there are two curves, so is there a way to roll them at the same time?
No, you don't do it at the same time.
No, I understand.
Yeah, each one is described by a Lobner equation its respective domain.
Right. So each one, I mean, the second one is an actual SLE. The first one is a piece of an SLE. It's just an excursion of an SLE. This is a curve which is distributed as an excursion of an SLE6 off the boundary. This has the polynomial distribution. And the second piece is distributed like an SLE inside this domain. Okay, so this is how you get the loops. I think this could be a good point to stop, unless you want to hear something about the near critical scale, but that might be a little bit too much for the audience. You should tell me. Be honest.
No, I'd like to know. Sorry.
You would like to hear something. Why don't we do this then? We just finish the formal session, and after 2 minutes, everybody who wants to leave can leave, and then you maybe give us a short idea, a brief introduction of 10 minutes or something. Maybe would that work?
Yeah.
When you take this out of your critical point.
Right. That works.
So. Okay. Thanks.
We now have a
have the definition. One is closer than the other.
That's an example.
So should we continue perhaps?
Yes, I think so.
All right.
First of all, they should not depend on the lattice that you're using because of the universality, obviously. But you can actually prove it, everything. Up to this point, everything can be proved, but only for the for this particular lattice. Now, what I'm, from now on, everything that has to do with near critical scaling limit, this is, we cannot prove anything at all. So this is all heuristic. But the point is that you can, it seems that you can use the full scale limit for this description in terms of loops to try to understand at least the sort of the geometry of the near critical scaling limit, which is the following. Once you understand the phase diagram, once you understand the behavior at the critical point, the next question is interesting is, how does the system behave when you're sort of just slightly off the critical point and you're converging to the critical point as delta, the lattice spacing, goes to zero? So you go to the critical points in the scaling limit. So that corresponds to choosing a density, which is 1/2 plus some constant lambda times delta. Delta is the lattice spacing to some power. So for people familiar with scaling theory, it will be immediately obvious that this this exponent that I call theta has to be 1/nu, where nu is the exponent related to the correlation line, the divergence of the correlation line. So this is the only choice that gives you something which is, that has a chance of giving you something which is non-trivial, and which will depend on lambda, because if you choose an exponent which is say smaller than that, then you converge to p2 quickly, and then you basically get again the critical case. And if you have an exponent which is smaller, sort of larger than you, you go to lambda to the critical value too slowly, and then your system looks supercritical if lambda is positive, and then what you get is not interesting. So that is specific, that's a choice you have to make. and it's the only possibility. And actually, I will, there's another way of getting this exponent, which I will show in a couple of transparencies, and I think explains certain things. Now, how can one understand, suppose you know what this, I told you, you know what the scaling limit of the critical point is. It's a it's this sort of gas for loops that I call X. It's a random object. And now the goal is to try to understand the near critical scaling limit by starting with from this object X. And the idea is the following. So the idea requires some, requires a picture. So if you want to, so the basic idea is what the problem is called for coupling between different population models, which is the following. And suppose you want to, use your computer to get a population configurations, what would you do? Well, one thing you can do, one sensible thing to do is to each hexagon you assign a random variable uniform between 0 and 1. Okay, then you fix the value of p and you say, okay, if my random variable is smaller than or equal to p, then I color the hexagon white, otherwise I color it black. Okay, so this is a very useful method. I mean, you can see that you can assign these random variables once, and then you can simply change your p, and you will get various configurations of probability. I mean, there are various population configurations for different values of the density of y. So you're sort of, this is what Probus would say, that you have coupled all the possible population models with different values of p, using, and you're using just one set of random variables. So you construct all these models on the same probability space, which is the set of the probability space of the random variables uniform between 0 and 1. And this is also useful because now if you look at this, you could say, okay, let me start. So I want to try to understand what happens in the near critical case. I can start at the critical case when p is 1/2, and then in this picture I sort of say, take a lambda positive, for example, and I start to move away from 1/2. Meaning I have my set of uniform random variables, I put down a configuration for p equals 1/2, and then I start to see that I look at the picture, and as I move my threshold, I look at the hexagons, and some of them will change from black to white. So now the point is, when this happens, what happens to the connectivity in the model? Or if you want, what happens to the loops? And the basic ansatz is that only the changes of color at some very special hexagons, which I call macroscopically difficult, will be important. And then only some of these hexagons will actually change color. Okay? And now let me try to explain it. So suppose this is for p equals 1/2, and now I have a positive lambda, now I start to change my threshold, and then some of the black hexagons will become white.
Sorry, I'm not quite understanding, because you get a different realization of the picture when you have to, you know, do the...
No, but the thing is that I don't choose the uniform random variables again. I keep the same, and I simply... So I assign the random variables between 0 and y and 1 once only.
Oh.
And then as I change the threshold, mm-hmm. that's the okay. thing. I want to... I choose them only once.
So it's like you have a random height function and a water
right.
level, and you're increasing
yes,
the water.
Exactly. That's a good description. You can think of those as random height, and then you feel up to some level. And if you're underwater, you're white, and you're black, otherwise you're white. Okay. Or is the other way around? It's the other way around. The way I was saying it. Okay. So, well, when you do this, as I start to move away from my mouth, some of the black hexagons will now become white. But I'm interested, since eventually I'm interested in the scaling, that I'm only interested in changes that make sort of macroscopic, have a macroscopic effect. And you will see that, you see, it's immediately obvious that most of the hexagons that will change actually have absolutely no effect. Because, I mean, if I change this one, yes, an interface will disappear, but it's a very tiny one. Or if I, you know, I can modify also a very big, this might be a very big interface, but if I change it here, the change is going to be extremely small, so it's completely irrelevant. But not all changes are going to be relevant. And if I look at this very big interface, and here it touches this other big interface, they might actually be pieces of the same one. It doesn't matter. At this level, I don't know. But you see that if by chance I happen to change exactly one of the green hexagons, then the change is going to be very big. Because this interface, instead of going this way, will just hook up with this one, and it will change very drastically. In terms of connectivity, here in this picture, you have a black, left-right black crossing. If you change any one of these hexagons from black to white, then it will disappear, and you will have a top-to-bottom white crossing. So those are the only. So in the ansatz that I. What I said before, only the change of color of some hexagons, these hexagons will be important. And these are hexagons, you see where they're called pivotal, and these are hexagons where you have two big loops coming as close as possible. At the discrete level, they cannot really touch, but they can come to the most distance one. Or it could be that it's one very big, loop that touches itself. So those are the special ones. And the other thing is, I mean, since I'm changing and moving away from one half, but not by much, because delta is going to zero, only some of the pivotal ones will change, not many of them actually. You mean, the thing is that, put it down here, the thing is that, you know, you have to be, so if U, H is a hexagon and U is the random variable between 0 and 1, for your hexagon, pivotal hexagon to change color, its value of the random variable should be close enough, very close to 1 half. So only some selected hexagons, some very special ones, will change. So, as I said, these are these hexagons are called pivotal hexagons. They are the ones basically who decide whether you have crossing, say, a vertical crossing or of one color or a horizontal crossing of the other color. And it turns out, in fact, using SLE, that you can compute the probability, of this event, of having a pivotal hexagon in there. You look at a configuration in a box of size 1 with the lattice spacing delta, what is the probability that you have a pivotal hexagon there? And it goes like delta to the 5 over 4. So the plane, if you look at how many, what is the number, roughly the number of pivotal hexagons that you will see in a box of size 1, then you immediately see that this goes like delta to the minus 3 over 4. Okay? Because you have, because this is a probability that you actually see such an event. And so this should look familiar. This is, now if you look back again at this choice of the exponent theta, this tells you that this is the choice that will make you, so if, with this particular choice, what happens is that the expected number of pivotal hexagons that will flip in a macroscopic domain of size 1, say, is of order 1. So this is another way of explaining why the value of theta should be this one, because if you choose something different, you will either flip, change the color of too many pivotal hexagons, And then you destroy everything and your configuration starts to look super critical, so the scaling image is not going to be interesting. Or you're not changing basically any pure hexagons because the probability is too small. And so you don't see any difference between what you're doing and the critical case. So this is sort of an independent way that, and this is something that in a way tells you, or is quite convincing, basically tells you that this ansatz is actually the correct one, because it gives you the right exponent in a completely different independent way. So it sort of suggests that it's really the case that the important things to look at are these macroscopically repeatable hexagons. In some sense, the essence of the ansatz is that we are assuming that the only important changes are the ones caused by single hexagons, single pivotal hexagons changing color. Well, I mean, in principle, this doesn't have to be true, because you could, you know, it could be the case that you have two hexagons and they are not pivotal, but if you change both of them simultaneously, then you have a big change in the connectivity. Now, the ansatz is telling you that these pairs of hexagons, or triples, or whatever you want, are not going to be important. So it's obvious that, I mean, if you want them to have an effect, if you want to change two, then you have, this is an event which is much less likely, because you have to change both of them. But it could be that the number of such pairs is so much larger that they still have an effect. And the ansatz is saying that this is not the case. So the only ones you have to care about are the single pivotal hexagons.
But that's a conjecture, or?
This is a conjecture. But it seems to be supported by this other argument that gives you the three or four by looking at the sort of the number of pivotal hexagons in the
correlation function
with the physical hexagons.
That's the energy.
Yeah, I thought it was energy. It wasn't entirely obvious from the picture that you drew where you defined the pivotal. Can you go back?
Yes, this one you mean?
Yeah.
So this is a very schematic picture. I mean, the pivotal means.
So how do I know this pivotal?
Well, because so this represents a white left to right crossing, almost crossing, and this is black. And depending, so whether you realize one crossing or the other depends only on the state of that hexagon, on the color of that one. And if you color it white, then you do have a left to right white crossing. If you change the color, then you completely destroy it, and then you have a black top and bottom.
So once you've flipped one, then that completely changes which ones might be pivotal.
Well, pivotal is actually independent of the color. Pivotal depends on the color of everything around it, but not on the color of the hexagon itself, if you think of the definition. The definition is sort of...
It may not be pivotal for a left-right crossing, but it would be pivotal for maybe a halfway crossing or something.
Like yeah. So as you crank up lambda, then you're flipping wrong. But it doesn't. But you can keep the ones that you've already decided are pivotal.
Right.
And you just enlarge that set.
Yes. Yes.
As you increase lambda.
Yes. The set of pivotal ones is going to change as lambda. I mean, as you move your value of lambda.
Well, yes, the ones which are pivotal, but once you've decided that you're going to flip that particular one,
yes,
then that
has some effect, and it will change your
you get a new set. You've got to have over that one, but the set doesn't have to contain the previous set. So if you go back to a picture of the ones you had with about five or six green pivotal bonds, if I flip the far left one, then the far right is no longer pivotal.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
So if you flip one of them...
But those are going to have...
I mean, this picture, so...
But The chance of getting two nearby each other, both of which will have their U values close enough to a half, will be so small that.
So, I mean, if one of those is going to change color, that's already an unlikely event, you're never going to see two close by, which simultaneously or almost all the same value of lambda change color. But anyway, so the point is that these pivotal hexagons correspond to places where two loops are come as close as possible, or where a single loop comes close as possible to itself. So once you take the scaling units and your sort of discrete loops, or I mean polygonal loops, become these continuous loops, those would be places where loops touch each other or where loop touches itself. So that's why I was saying before that this effectiveness, a lot of touching is crucial. So in some sense, if you want to understand how the geometry of the loops is changed, so in the discrete setting, it's easy. I mean, you have to keep track of these, and you want to kind of count them, and to each one you want to assign a value, which is sort of the value of lambda at which it will change color. And then as you move your lambda, you simply look at which ones change color, and you know, you flip it and you know it's obvious how to decrement things. So in the discrete, in the continuum setting, you want to do the analogous thing. You have the set of points where loops touch each other or touch themselves, and you want to some of these points, you want to mark them and give them a value for which value of lambda it will sort of flip, and then you have to reconnect things in the more or less obvious way. Now, the thing which is completely conjectural is, well, we don't know how to mark these points. In the strict setting, this is a counting measure, because you're simply counting them and then you're assigning a lambda value. But what is the scaling unit of this procedure? It's not obvious because, I mean, if you look at two loops touching, this is like an SLE6 touching another SLE6, because the loops locally look like SLE6 pattern. So, I mean, the set of these points, these are fractal sets, and you want to put a measure on these points, and sort of, it's kind of clear, I guess, that, but this is our guess, because, I mean, the type of, so you have in some, you could describe this as a point process on this fractal set of touching points where there is touching. And this point process should be a Poisson type of point. Poisson point process, because again, because of the nature of percolation, things that happen far away, they don't influence each other. So the events that are the way you mark points in the two different parts of the plane, they have no effect on each other, so they're completely independent. So they should be some kind of Poisson process, but we have no idea what this is. So the things are sort of this level. I mean, you can describe a way of constructing a one-parameter family of loop models, which are indexed by a parameter lambda, and lambda equal to zero corresponds to the critical point. But you know, in order to make this construction more concrete, we need to provide some measure for these touching points, for how to mark the touching points. Yes?
Can I have a question? So if I, say, take one of these boxes with black color, top and bottom, white, left and right, and I ask if there is a left-white crossing of whites. So I choose a configuration. There's going to be some macroscopic probability that there are pivotal points, right?
Yeah.
So that there is a crossing, but there are pivotal points. And but then if I start, you know, raising or lowering whichever it is, the level of water, at some point it will switch.
Yeah.
Right. And do you think the point at which it switches has a macroscopic probability of being a hexagon that was pivotal to begin with? There will be some hexagon that does the job, does the
yes, so the hexagon that does the job is going to be a pivotal hexagon.
Well, when it does the job, it will be pivotal.
Yes.
But what it might not be half the pivotal to begin with.
Yeah, that might be.
And the question is, do you think that there is a probability not tending to zero, the macroscopic probability?
That the hexagon that does the job in some area of lambda was not pivotal at the very beginning, lambda was zero.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, pivotal hexagons are in this landscape, the saddles at the sea level.
Okay, so
and if you lower the sea level, it's a different set of saddles.
Yeah, so you're asking whether I should consider only the only important set is instead of pivotal as lambda zero, lambda equals zero, or I have to update my set of pivotal points at every value of lambda.
Well, clearly you have to update. But the question is whether
your question is whether it's really necessary to update or
well, it's whether is there. I mean, it's sort of clear that the probability isn't going to be one, that one of your original pivotal sites did the job.
Yeah.
It won't be tending to one. The question is it tending to zero? Because it could be that you're much more likely to connect these things to a chain of little clusters that get added one at a time
right. Than
you are to have one of the original pivots do the job.
Right.
You know, you could give some intuition as to why that would be the case, because if you take your initial path and you raise around it a little bit, then your path is going to be replaced with a path that is shifted over slightly. And likely no points, the sort of measure of the points that were, if you look at your second path and look at the points where it hits the first path, that's probably a set of zero measure. And so then if you condition on that and then put this other set on top of it, there will be points. I should probably be quiet or drop this or postpone this.
I understand the question, but I don't know the answer.
Well, let me try to give a guess at the answer. So I think it doesn't go to zero, but I would describe it a little differently. That is, rather than focusing on being pivotal for a particular thing, like a left-right crossing, once you talk about pivotal as simply meaning that there are two white arms and two black arms coming out from the hexagon, which extend the minimum of all those four distances is some length, some macroscopic length, let's call it epsilon. And then what happens when you start changing lambda from zero should be that a typical pivotal hexagon whose value of lambda will change as an order of one, as you change lambda, the epsilon will change. So maybe rather than being macroscopically pivotal of length, epsilon now will only be epsilon over two because you somehow cut off something. So it may no longer make a left-right crossing, it will make it somehow sort of a shorter difference in crossing, but it will still be macroscopically pivotal. That's a slightly different way of looking at it. I think that claim is roughly equivalent to the claim that the probability that it's pivotal for the same event doesn't go to zero.
Yeah,
it's a claim, it's not a...
I would tend to have an opposite guess. But maybe we should probably end here and go to a chalkboard discussion.
It's of course an important issue because somehow our picture is based on looking at the critical model and doing all the markings etc. for it.
Sure.
And if what your conjecture is right, then that probably isn't a good thing to do because then how can you keep on changing lambda?
Yeah. Although your procedure is totally different, in field theory, we know that it's not a good idea to try to construct a massive field theory. by perturbing about the massless one. It doesn't work very well.
Well, this is sort of percolation is kind of a special case.
Percolation is somehow special, right?
I mean, here, this construction is really using some very special aspects of percolation. I agree. I know that this wouldn't work for anything else. I mean, if it was tried to do this for easing, of course, it wouldn't make any sense.
No, I'm not. There are dangerous things that happen.
Is it, I mean, it's more specifically, is it clear from these pictures why it didn't work for icing? I mean, or what?
Well, I mean,
if I look at pictures.
If you look at pictures, but I mean, even the previous step of the construction of the full scale limit uses the locality laws, mm-hmm. which you don't have for any other value.
But isn't Scott Hotel something different tomorrow that you can do it for other values of capital?
This?
No, not this, but the full.
The full, yeah, but not with this construction.
The full scale.
The loops?
Yeah.
Well, you can construct the loops.
Yeah.
The whole set of loops.
For any cap.
Yeah.
I mean, when cap is between 4 and 8, you can use essentially this construction where you replace SLE kappa with SLE kappa kappa minus 6. When you're in this SLE kappa rho, when you have monochromatic boundary conditions, and then you get bichromatic boundary conditions, you just do regular SLE kappa. But anyhow, there are other ways to do it, things that work when kappa is less than 4, but that's for tomorrow.
So it's not clear. I mean, the sort of language that you've used here would work for any of the FK.
We know an exponent comes from this, a two-hull exponent, which is the energy exponent that takes you out of a critical point. It's exactly coming from two clusters coming from this.
Yeah, so there might be.
So you think that this might actually be general? I mean, even the construction of the loops, it gets already more complicated. So the fact that here you don't feel the effect of the boundary. I mean, for example, if in your construction for the values of kappa, you already have to use.
No, but you can always put a little weight on. You weight by the number of black hexagons. Mm-hmm. You have a tiny weight, and you know, and within the right. You know, if you have some marginicity, you are increasing the weight because you strip more black hexagons, then you can have a coupling of all the different weights, and you can gradually increase the number of black hexagons, and you'll have these special times when these pivots appear.
So the only thing that happens when Q is not 1 in the FK model is, of course, when you reconnect, you totally change the number of clusters in that.
That changes the measure.
And that changes the measure.
Right.
Yeah.
I never thought much about this. I don't know.
All right, let's thank the Federico last time.